The headlines: President Rouhani rejects U.S. and European concerns about Iran's enrichment capabilities and reiterates that Tehran is not seeking to develop nuclear weapons. Sources say the U.S. is about to announce a set of sanctions on Russia that are expected to target the country's sovereign debt. And also in our headlines, U.S. police face off with protesters in Minnesota's Brooklyn Center on the fourth night of demonstrations against the fatal shooting of a black man by a white officer. Hello and welcome, everybody. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has dismissed U.S. and European concerns over his country's decision to enrich uranium to 60% purity, saying the Islamic Republic's nuclear program is peaceful.
Their claim that we are paving the way for an atomic bomb is their utter mistake. We are capable of 90% enrichment on this very day if we decide to do so. But from the very beginning, they have announced that we keep our promises and that our nuclear activities are entirely peaceful.
Rouhani reiterated that Tehran is not seeking to develop nuclear weapons. He said such accusations must address those that are keeping and stockpiling nukes for long. The Iranian president said the only option for the U.S. and other signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal is to get back to full compliance with their commitments. He said after the verification of their measures, Iran would also return to compliance under the JCPOA. Rouhani also hailed the successful inauguration of the country's major projects with breakthroughs in the production field despite economic sanctions and the coronavirus pandemic. Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal are set to be in another round of talks in the Austrian capital later on Thursday with the aim of reviving the accord. Malesky joined us earlier with the latest on the upcoming talks.
The joint commission session will be led by the political director, so the Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi is heading the Iranian team, and representing the EU will be Mr. Enrique Mora, as well as, of course, the deputy foreign ministers and political directors of the other sides. Now, the main issue that's been causing a lot of complicated discussions has been exactly what sanctions the U.S. needs to remove. Iran has made it clear that it wants all of the sanctions, both those that were reimposed under President Trump and the additional sanctions that Trump introduced after the U.S. withdrew from the nuclear deal in 2018, to be removed fully. But it looks like, at least on the surface of it, the United States has said that's been reflected in various media reports that it is willing to remove the JCPOA-related sanctions or any sanctions that violate the JCPOA, but there are still discussions on the other sanctions.
The Yemeni army has launched a new attack on Saudi Arabia in retaliation for the kingdom's ongoing war on the country. Army spokesman Yahya Sarai says several locations in Jizan region, including an Aramco oil facility and a Patriot missile battery, were targeted. He says 11 missiles and drones were used in the operation. Yahya Sarai said the attack is a response to a Saudi airstrike on Wednesday in Saada province that killed two children and wounded several others. Sarai warned that the retaliatory attacks will continue as long as Riyadh's airstrikes and its blockade continue. Saudi Arabia waged its war on Yemen 6 years ago. Tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have lost their lives as a result. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdullatif Al-Washali, says the Yemeni army seeks to push Saudi Arabia and its allies to the negotiating table by its retaliatory attacks.
The Yemeni army says the retaliatory attacks, will persist as long as the Saudi war and the siege are continued against the Yemeni people. There are some news now saying the Saudis are moving toward the political solution with the observation of the special envoy, the UN special envoy for Yemen. I believe that the retaliatory attacks, the continued offensive on the ground by the Yemeni army, are pushing Saudi Arabia and its allies to move towards the political solution to end the war on the Yemeni people, to end also the siege imposed on the Yemeni people for the seventh year. The Yemenis are now suffering severe fuel shortage for months now. Not even a liter of petrol was allowed to enter the country because of the continued detention of the oil vessels by the Saudi Arabia.
The U.S. is reportedly set to impose a wide range of sanctions on Russia for alleged election interference and cyber espionage, U.S. media cited. Sources familiar with the matter saying that the sanctions are expected to target more than 30 entities. The sources said at least 10 Russians, including diplomats, will also be expelled from the U.S. Reports also say President Joe Biden is expected to issue an executive order barring U.S. banks from purchasing ruble-denominated bonds from June. The sanctions come partly in response to a cyber attack targeting American companies and government offices. The U.S. claims Russia was behind the attack. Washington also accuses the Russian president of directing efforts to hurt Biden's candidacy during the 2020 presidential election. Russia denies the allegations. The United States has reaffirmed its partnership with Chinese Taipei during a visit to the island by an American delegation.
We are here today as a bipartisan delegation, and I appreciate your words, Madam President, about the bipartisan nature of our delegation at the request of my longstanding friend, President Joe Biden, to reaffirm the U.S. commitment to this partnership and to deepening our cooperation on the multitude of interests that we share in common.
In his meeting with President Tsai Ing-wen of Chinese Taipei, the U.S. envoy underlined that the Biden administration will be a reliable, trusted friend for her. Dodd underlined that Washington will help Chinese Taipei expand its international space and support its investments in self-defense. He said the Biden administration will also work towards deepening economic ties with Taipei. The trip comes amid Beijing's escalating tensions with the United States over a host of issues. Beijing has repeatedly called on the U.S. to abide by the One China principle, properly handle the issue of Chinese Taipei. Independent China strategist Andrew K.P. Loing says China has made it clear that it will defend its territorial integrity if Chinese Taipei declares independence.
There is a bipartisan consensus behind the long-established Taiwan Relations Act in the United States. This act requires the United States to continue to support the defense of Taipei without apparently giving up this so-called one China policy. Of course, that this is a kind of nebulous concept. By continuing feeding Taiwan with high-grade military hardware and software, and also by stroking the kind of Taiwan self-determination or independence movement, if Taiwan is going to declare de facto independence, it was not necessarily de jure independence, by enacting legislations within Taiwan or by fostering Taiwan as a separate country, then China is fully prepared to use military force.
Elsewhere, police have used smoke grenades and flashbangs to disperse protesters. In the U.S. state of Minnesota, on the fourth night of unrest against the police killing of a black man, the protesters chanted the name of the victim, Dante Wright, in Brooklyn Center and demanded justice for him. The 20-year-old black man was fatally shot by a white officer, Kimberly Potter, who is now charged with second-degree manslaughter. Wright was initially pulled over on Sunday by the police for an expired registration tag on his vehicle. The shooting has once again escalated tensions in Minnesota, where a similar incident last year ignited months of anti-racism rallies and clashes between the protesters and the police. Colin Campbell says the trend of fatal police shootings in the United States would continue unless there is a police reform.
There are a myriad ways of things that people have bounced around, different members of the community, coming from the business community, religious community, academic community, even law enforcement services themselves, that say there needs to be a different type of training involved if we want these types of occasions and these incidents to be decreased or not to happen at all. One of the things that one of the ideas that's bounced around is really eliminating the idea of police in general and moving more towards a public safety model where you have officers, there would still be officers or people who patrol, but looking to de-escalate situations and protect the public rather than policing the public. And even though there, that seems to be a strange distinction where you would say that, okay, they're police, that they're still protecting the public, many believe that the way that they've become more militarized over the past few years, more aggressive over the past few years, and just their tactical training, how that's changed over the past few years, it's less on protecting the public, but more on policing the public,
right,
incarcerating, subjugating, controlling, and trying to bring justice, sometimes extrajudicially, as we've seen with Dante White, as we've seen with George Floyd, and so many other young black men, and sometimes black women as well.
India has reported a record high of over 200,000 new COVID-19 infections amid an acute shortage of hospital beds and medical equipment. This was the seventh day, a record daily jump in the last 8 days. The country also suffered more than 1,000 daily deaths. India's total infections now stand at over 14.1 million, with more than 173,000 deaths. The western state of Maharashtra, home to India's commercial hub Mumbai, accounts for almost a quarter of the country's total cases. The capital, New Delhi, is also setting new records for daily infections. Health officials say hospitals in the city and several other regions are now overwhelmed, warning the surge could be deadlier than in 2020. India has seen a surge in cases since early March, with authorities blaming the jump on crowding and people's reluctance to wear masks. Apprehensions of asylum seekers on the United States border with Mexico have reached their highest level in 15 years. Many say it's an unpopular backtrack from new President Joe Biden, who promised to replace the anti-immigrant policies of his predecessor, Donald Trump. Rami Mazzotti reports from Chicago.
United States President Joe Biden has made a deal with Mexico, Guatemala, and Honduras to increase border security in order to prevent refugees from reaching the U.S. border. The leaders of Mexico and Guatemala criticized Biden for having initially sent compassionate messages that encouraged refugees to try and reunite with their families, only to find often brutal conditions and deplorable treatment at the U.S. border. Per capita, the U.S. accepts only a tiny amount of asylum seekers, and yet immigration appears to be the most talked about issue today. What's seemingly never discussed in the mainstream media is how U.S. foreign policy is so often the direct cause of the political instability and economic dysfunction which produces these regular refugee crises.
It feels odd to say even foreign policy, considering how deeply involved the U.S. has been in the development of Latin America, especially Central America, where a lot of these, you know, refugees and migrants are coming from. And this, you know, 100-year-long history is never addressed in the media. The wars in the 80s that Reagan waged against, you know, progressive governments and movements in Central America are never discussed. And even, like, extremely recent history, like the 2008 overthrow of the government in Honduras or the disputed 2017 election, are not discussed. And that is just recent history. It doesn't delve into, you know, the long history of colonialism, the Monroe Doctrine. People may have heard this in school, but they don't really understand what it means. It means the U.S. extracting resources from these countries. So it's no wonder that people would want to go from the areas the U.S. impoverished to the U.S., which has that wealth now.
Domestically, Republicans are being accused of fear-mongering about immigrants, while Democrats are being accused of using foreign immigration to distract from the unprecedented economic and health crises. The right to asylum is protected in international and U.S. law, but Biden appears to be following the same militaristic approach as his controversial predecessor, which many repeatedly called inhumane. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The unemployment gap between young black workers and young white workers in the U.K. was already wide, but according to a new study, the inequality gap during the pandemic has even worsened. Ahmed Cabello has more with his report from London.
Young black people have been hardest hit by unemployment during the pandemic, new research indicates. Over the past year, the UK jobless rate for young black people rose by more than a third to 35%, according to the Resolution Foundation think tank. That compared with a rate of 13% for young white people and a rate of 24% for young people of Asian descent. By the end of the year, unemployment among young black graduates had risen to 34%, up from 22% before the pandemic.
I graduated last year with a business degree, and I know COVID has, you know, really impacted the job market and all that stuff, but just being a black person as well, on top of that, it just makes things a lot harder.
Even if a black person has a degree and has just left university, they're finding it hugely difficult to get a job. And I think that's proof positive that Britain is a systemically racist society. Even in the year of 2021, we're seeing that time and time again, that the life chances, the opportunities available to black people are much worse than those available to the white population.
The findings follow the government's recent controversial report into race relations in British society, which claimed the UK does not suffer from institutional racism and should be a model for other white majority nations. Yet the research from the Resolution Foundation, along with other racial disparity statistics, paints a very different picture, which critics argue the government's report failed to acknowledge. In the British capital, London, young black males were 19 times more likely to be stopped and searched than the general population, and were 28 times more likely to be stopped on suspicion of carrying weapons than the general population. Black people were 6.5 times more likely to be fined than white people for breaking COVID-19 regulations, and more than 4 times more likely to die from COVID-19 than white people.
Black Britons, African Caribbeans and Asians face systemic racism. They're 9 times more likely to be stopped and searched by the police. As women, 3 times more likely to die in childbirth. Were 60% of the doctors and nurses and health frontline workers who died at the very beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. And for the government's report to say that institutional racism doesn't exist is just a kick in the teeth.
Foundation's findings exposed that COVID had widened already existing gaps between the UK's ethnic groups, and they've urged for special efforts to ensure that young people from hard-hit ethnic backgrounds had access to quality education, training options, and where needed, financial support for full-time study. But many will feel the government may not have the remedy for this issue while they refuse to accept the diagnosis, systemic racism. Ahmed Cabello, London.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Calls grow for U.S. President Joe Biden to end all U.S. support for Saudi Arabia which is preventing food, medicine, fuel, and other aid from reaching starving Yemenis. Dear listeners, please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jake Johnson Ryder. This article is titled, Calls Mount for Biden to End U.S. Complicity in Starvation of Yemen. Here's more on this issue. A strike launched by Detroit-based anti-war activists in protest of the Saudi-led blockade of Yemen entered its 17th day on Wednesday, April 14th, as calls grow for U.S. President Joe Biden to end all U.S. support for the kingdom's deadly restrictions, which are preventing food, medicine, fuel, and other aid from reaching starving Yemenis. Iman Saleh, a 26-year-old Yemeni-American taking part in the hunger strike, wrote in a Washington Post op-ed recently that the siege against Yemen not only has had a crippling effect on everyday life, but it is also compounding the ongoing conflict in the country, causing damage that exceeds even the violence itself in both scale and intensity. After days without food, I have lost much of my short-term memory. Day in and day out, I feel the physical burden of starvation that my people have endured for so long. But my pain cannot amount to that of Yemenis under siege, Saleh continued. I am starving, but I'm not being starved. I'm suffering, but I can choose to end that suffering, she added. Saleh and other members of the Yemeni liberation movement are demanding that Biden immediately cut off U.S. support for the Saudi blockade and pressure Riyadh to lift the restrictions. In February, Biden vowed to end U.S. assistance for all of the Saudi-led coalition's offensive operations in Yemen. But the president has been quiet on the blockade, which one analyst characterized as an offensive military operation that kills civilians. As Saleh and her fellow activists have rallied in the nation's capital in recent days to demand action from the Biden administration, a growing cohort of Democrats in Congress is showing solidarity with the hunger strikers and pressuring the White House to do everything in its power to bring about an end to the devastating land, air, and sea blockade. I do hope that those who are watching realize that the longer that you are all on a hunger strike, the longer that there are people actually dying in Yemen, Representative Ilhan Omar said in an emotional speech to demonstrators in Washington, D.C. recently. In a report released earlier this year, several United Nations agencies warned that 400,000 Yemeni children under the age of 5 could die of starvation this year without urgent humanitarian help as their country is ravaged by the coronavirus pandemic, strangled by the blockade, and bombarded by air strikes from the Saudi-led, U.S.-backed coalition. The World Food Program estimated that 50,000 Yemenis are facing famine-like conditions, with 5 million a mere step away from this worst-case scenario. A further 11 million people are facing crisis levels of food insecurity, the organization said. In 2021, around half of all children under 5 in Yemen, that is about 2.3 million, are projected to face acute malnutrition. The people of Yemen are without water, without food, without electricity, Representative Jamal Bauman said in a video posted to Twitter. A child is dying every 75 seconds. half of the country is starving because of the Saudi Arabian blockade. We need for Saudi Arabia to immediately lift the blockade and allow food and aid into Yemen. Every nation should be standing up and speaking out. President Biden, please demand that the Saudis lift the blockade and let us bring aid into Yemen, Bauman continued. People are starving, children are dying, and it's on us to do more and do better, he added. Yara Baden, an activist taking part in the hunger strike, echoed that message in an interview with Middle East Eye. At the end of the day, who is paying? It's the innocent people in Yemen who have nothing to do with anything that's happening, Baden said of the Saudi-led U.S.-backed war on Yemen, which began in 2015. And we are complicit. The United States is complicit. In the same February speech in which he pledged to end all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, Biden also said that we are going to continue to support and help Saudi Arabia defend its sovereignty and its territorial integrity and its people. As Vox Alex Watt reported recently, some analysts believe Riyadh took that as implicit support for the blockade, even as the Biden administration has consistently expressed the free flow of fuel and goods into Yemen is critical. That may partly explain why Saudi Arabia has kept the restrictions in place, Ward noted. In March, for instance, CNN found that Saudi warships had kept all oil tankers from docking in port of Hodeida since the start of the year. In a letter to Biden recently, nearly 80 House Democrats led by Representatives Rokana, Debbie Dingell, and Mark Pocan implored the president to use all available U.S. leverage with the Saudi regime to demand an immediate and unconditional end to its blockade, which threatens 16 million malnourished Yemenis living on the brink of famine. The Saudi blockade has long been a leading driver of Yemen's humanitarian catastrophe, triggering recent fuel shortages, inflation, and greatly reducing access to food, water, electricity, and transportation, the lawmakers wrote. Every day that we wait for these issues to be resolved in negotiations is another day that pushes more children to the brink of death.
September 11, the date the U.S. was hit with a terrorist act. It invaded and occupied Afghanistan shortly after that, and it will be the same date that it will withdraw its forces from that country. What does the U.S. have to show for it after almost 20 years of war and occupation? Well, not much, considering that the group it wanted to eliminate won't even attend talks with it, settling only for its ouster. The U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, the subject of this edition of the debate.
The phrase of September 11 revives the memory of terrorist attacks in the U.S. that later in October 2001 brought the U.S. and NATO troops in Afghanistan in the name of International Security Assistance Forces, ISAF. Earlier, in a joint press conference with NATO chief, the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, said that the two sides would work together on a safe, deliberate and coordinated withdrawal of their forces from Afghanistan. Officials in Kabul also say the decision would be later discussed by the presidents of Afghanistan and the U.S.
The Afghan government respects the U.S. decision, and the presidents of both countries are going to discuss the issue again. Afghanistan's security and defense forces are capable of protecting the country. They have done so in the past and will do so in the future.
This comes as the withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan was agreed between the Taliban and the U.S. during negotiations in the Qatari capital Doha last year. With such change on Washington's policy, the Taliban has also declared that it's not willing to attend Turkey summit until foreign troops are stationed in Afghanistan. Government officials here believe the presence of foreign troops in Afghanistan is not the main cause behind Taliban's decision not to attend Turkey summit, but it's a pretext for the militants to further wage the war in the country.
Taliban has wasted time over the past year by fueling the flames of war instead of trying to bring peace. The presence of foreign troops in Afghanistan is a pretext for the Taliban to continue their illegal war against our people.
As the Taliban has become a serious headache for the U.S. despite 20 years of fighting, many here argue that there would be no win for no one via military ways. Therefore, they want Taliban and other players to set aside their differences and reach a comprehensive agreement in order to lead this wounded part of the world to peace and stability. However, the issue of withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan is not the only matter of concern for the Taliban, as there are some other key factors that affect groups looked toward Turkey summit, including the fate of political system in Afghanistan. Some observers worry that with foreign troops gone, Afghanistan will witness a rise in violence, but that can't be farther than the truth, as Afghan forces are well equipped to fight any security threat rapidly and effectively. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
For guests joining us for this edition of The Debate, we have Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition joining us from San Francisco. We also have Syed Mohsen Abbas, who's a journalist and political commentator, joining us from London. I'd like to welcome you both. Richard Becker, let me first start with you. Almost no sooner did the U.S. President Joe Biden begin his speech today, which is ongoing as we speak, did the words come out of his mouth that said, our reasons for staying in Afghanistan have become increasingly unclear. After 20 years for the U.S. president to say that, it speaks volumes. What is your impression of what he has said there?
Well, you know, there's very little honesty that comes from the U.S. government on foreign policy issues, and this is another example of not facing up to the reality of what has really been the role of the United States in Afghanistan. The common saying is that it's the longest war, or second longest war in U.S. history, and it started in 2001, but really the war against Afghanistan started in 1979 and was later confessed to by U.S. leaders after they were out of office. So really we've seen more than four decades of U.S. intervention, which has wreaked havoc on the country. First it was to overthrow a progressive government that attempted in the late 70s and 1980s to implement changes that would improve the lot of people who were still living in a semi-feudal society in most of Afghanistan. And we see in 2001, after the U.S. had been out of Afghanistan for a period of years, and go back in on the pretext that this was, you know, to as revenge, and it really was for revenge, but the pretext that this was somehow to help people, help women. That was a theme that was played. All U.S. intervention has done in Afghanistan is wreak destruction on the country and the people of Afghanistan at an enormous cost in human lives and treasure.
Syed Mohsen Abbas, I mean, really, if you really want to look at what has happened there, 20 years of the U.S. being there, along with some of the other NATO member countries, at one point, I believe, the highest number came in at around 100,000 troops maybe a little bit more. And yet you're dealing with 5,000, 6,000 Taliban. I mean, why did the U.S. and its NATO partners, countries, not be able to defeat the Taliban?
I think it's a false strategic analysis on the part of the American establishment that they could ever achieve victory. That's the best I can say for them. The other is to say that cynically they knew perfectly well that they wouldn't be able to do this. In fact, they just needed to be there for their own geopolitical and resource rate agendas. You know, there is far more wealth in Afghanistan than people realize. There's far more also strategic importance given the, for instance, the Russian presence, the Chinese Belt Road Initiative, Pakistan and India, you know, so huge interests, not least of all, to mention that the Islamic Republic of Iran, who the Americans have been after, is next door as well. So Afghanistan was vital, not for the reasons they were saying, which was to hunt down terrorists, but rather for the purpose of advancing their own greed and their own hegemony in the region. Now, the net result you talked about, after 20 years of what I call occupation of Afghanistan, despite the fact they declare victory, laughably along the way as well, they use torture, they've done the rendition exercises on individuals, 15,000 pound bombs, drone strikes, and tens of thousands of troops, as you've mentioned, have been involved. But today, that is still the Taliban that control the vast majority of Afghanistan and who are present in most of the country. Of course, what other results? Well, we can see that Al-Qaeda, which was only based in remote parts of Afghanistan when they said they would go in at best, and even there we know that the Al-Qaeda link is very strongly connected to American deep state itself. Whilst it was supposed to be in remote parts of Afghanistan before, it's sprouted globally, you know, with franchises in Iraq, which we all know very well, you know, the ISIS AQI fraternity in Yemen, in North Africa, the Levant, and beyond. So Al-Qaeda eventually transformed into ISIS that we know in Camp Buka at Abu Ghraib after its leaders met with former members of Saddam's regime. That was another gift from the American war of terror that they inflicted on Afghanistan, which had reverberations everywhere. Of course, hundreds of thousands killed, maimed, or displaced by both invasions that they carried out as well. I mean, I could go on, but I think that's kind of gives people an idea of the huge global terrorism which has increased because of the so-called American intervention to stop terrorism. You know, it's been an absolute disaster.
Yeah, Richard Becker, just a few years back, based on 2,000 pages of previously, at that point, unpublished notes of interviews with the generals and people who played a direct role in the war, and diplomats to be included in there, and aid workers, you name Afghan officials, part of this really vast investigation. The findings that came out were shocking. One of them, U.S. officials constantly had said that they were making progress in Afghanistan, but they failed to tell the truth about the war throughout the campaign, making rosy pronouncements that they knew were false and hiding unmistakable evidence that the war had become unwinnable. Now, this is going back a few years when the findings came out, referring back to the years before that. If that was the case, then what reasons did the U.S. have to continue for what this is stated, one of the findings, that it was an unwinnable war?
Well, there's actually nothing new about this. I mean, that's what the Pentagon Papers were all about back at the time of the Vietnam War, after the war had gone on and huge casualties had already taken place and massive destruction of Vietnam. And then the Pentagon Papers came out, and the government tried to put on trial Daniel Ellsberg, the person who leaked the Pentagon Papers, who had worked for Rand Corporation. And what his crime was he exposed the reality of that war, and that after years of the American public being told, oh, we're winning, just, you know, another 50,000 troops and it'll be all over. I remember that when I was young. And it was, they knew from 1965 that they couldn't really win the war. But that had kept secret from the people. The same thing has happened also with Chelsea Manning and those who work with Chelsea Manning, Julian Assange, who revealed the reality. Their crime, if there was honesty in the system, they would charge them with the crime of exposing U.S. war crimes. The military always wants to go on until they get to a certain point and they know that it's impossible. But as your other guest said, Afghanistan has tremendous strategic importance. It's surrounded by several other states and states that are in contention with the United States right now. And the idea that not the Taliban, I don't believe, has sympathy with Russia or China or any of that, but the fact that Afghanistan could slip out of the grasp of the United States, the strategic grasp of the United States, that's what really kept them in the war for all this time, when knowing that they weren't going to be able to win. And I would say, add one thing to this, is that for years and years, they had known this. And still, they kept sending U.S. troops. And just to show the cynicism of the Pentagon and the war makers, they kept sending U.S. troops and other NATO troops out into forward operating bases, FOBs as they were called, really not for any other reason except to draw fire of the Taliban forces, of the anti-occupation forces, and then the U.S. could use air power to try to obliterate those forces. I mean, that's what people were doing out in the forward operating bases, year after year after year, when the military high command knew they couldn't win the war.
Yeah, and taxpayer money there, not to mention the exorbitant amount of money that was spent on a variety of issues in that country, like rebuilding, which never panned out the way that they wanted to. Now, Simonson Abbas, we could talk about how the U.S. has failed, but some of these fine details that came out on this investigation that I referred to are really mind-boggling, and I'm going to quote you what one of the three-star Army generals who served as the White House's Afghan war czar during the Bush and Obama administration. He said, quote, "We were devoid of a fundamental understanding of Afghanistan. We didn't know what we were doing there." In addition, he said, "What are we trying to do here? We didn't have the foggiest notion of what we were undertaking." What does that say about the U.S. and the way that its army is run?
Well, it says that there's absolutely no common sense and no analysis or genuine purpose for spreading what they often use as an excuse for going in and doing these things. Number one, the idea of catching terrorists, so-called terrorists. Then they had the other one, which is democracy. They've got to they're out in the world to spread democracy. And human rights. These are just three of the lines that they, use as a way of pushing their armies in. And of course, it's an industrial military complex, which one has to ask a serious question. Who's actually in control of this industrial military arms complex? Is it the Defense Secretary of America? Is it the Senate? Is it the President of America? Because quite frankly, who's going to take responsibility for all these millions of deaths which this industrial military complex has perpetrated across that region? Because there are millions. Once you count Iraq, you count Libya, you count Yemen, you count the Afghan region, the wars on Iran, let's not forget, all of these were initiated by that same machine. So what is the world going to do about that machinery, that industrial military complex, and who actually finances, powers, and manages it? There are a lot of course, questions about the money mafias and those who have corporate interests also using these military machines in order to sell all of their sort of weapons, Raytheon and all the other kind of Boeing and the various, Lockheed Martin, all those who profiteered out of the lives that have been lost are also culpable. There are a lot of criminals that need to be rounded up and taken into account. But of course, Western electorate don't know much, nor do they care very much about their foreign policies. They complain about immigrants, Afghan immigrants, when they started coming back here. But actually, if they stop invading other countries, pay more attention to their psychopathic leaders who they vote in, who then go on these war expeditions for their own corporate buddies' interests and their own financial interests, it may mean that even the West would suffer less from terrorism, suffer less from migrant crises, which they're now moaning and complaining about. They would have less anti-terror laws passed, which have been applied in perpetuity by all of these U.S. coalition nations, you know, which has changed society here in the West forever. In fact, the march towards capitalist totalitarianism is inexorable, along with COVID. But the wars of terror are actually what initiated those. You know, Islamophobia has gone through the roof in the West. You know, thousands of the coalition troops themselves have been maimed or killed. Those families, all in vain, have lost lives, lost people. So the damage and who actually is going to be, if you like, held culpable is the real shame of it, because right. Nobody will be, because there is no international body that can actually bring the war criminals like Bush, like Tony Blair, those who've been on these kind of crusades in the Muslim lands. Nobody's bringing them to task. They're running around free.
Right. Well, Richard Becker, if you want to take purely at the numbers here, we know that the U.S. has spent quite a bit of money in this country, not to mention the coalition forces from other countries. If we were to come out with some figures, I'm sure it would be a large figure. You would figure in 20 years' time, if that money was spent in the presence of U.S. forces and other countries' forces for the infrastructure of Afghanistan, that the country would be doing better, a country that's supposedly resource-rich. Kind of mirrors what has happened in Iraq. And it leads one to think, perhaps, that there wasn't really that much of a motivation for the U.S. to make sure that the country was built, its infrastructure, to have advanced. We know it has done some projects. Why wasn't the focus put more on that, to at least see Afghanistan prosper, Afghan people prosper that way?
Well, clearly that is not in interest. That's not what interests the leaders in the United States, both the politicians on the national level and the military politicians, the civilian politicians and the military politicians. What their real aim is global domination. And, you know, we've talked about this a lot. But the cost that is paid by the people of Afghanistan, the people of the world, by this immense waste of resources. I mean, it's unbelievable. The real military budget of the United States this year, they'll say it's $715 billion, but it won't be. It'll be really $1.2 trillion or something like that to pay for past wars and present wars. And this goes on year after year after year. If we look at what has been spent, you know, in just the last 20 years on wars, the wars in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, but the other wars are against Libya, Yemen, but the military budget as a whole. And it's a place where these military industrial corporations that your other guest is referring to, they feast on it. They grow richer and richer and richer, but the people pay for it. You know, we just lost a great humanitarian figure opposed to imperialism and domination, Ramsey Clark, the former U.S. Attorney General. And I traveled with him often into other countries, for him to speak, and he was always emphasizing this point, that this was a crime against the people. And he would quote Dr. Martin Luther King, who said, "The greatest purveyor of violence in the world today is my own government." That's even more true today than it was then.
Well, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, I'm looking through some of the quotes that Biden has made on this day, coming into the speech that he's made regarding the withdrawal. And another one stands out from what he has said, and that is what he referred to as terrorism. And let me make sure that I quote him accurately, that Biden says that the U.S. will continue to work to prevent the reemergence of terrorism. You would think 20 years would be enough, and it can't even provide, it can't even do that for its own country. How can Biden even make a claim to that effect when it has failed, not only in this country, Afghanistan, but also, for example, in Iraq?
Well,
Well, the claim is obviously. Sorry, I'm just going to have to back up, I think, a little bit. Yeah, my battery, sorry. Yeah. Your question is obviously, first of all, I can say how ludicrous the statement Biden made is. The bottom line is that America, you know, has now got a reputation worldwide, and it's renowned for that reputation of torture, and it's lost its credibility as a defender of justice. It's lost its credibility as a sort of a purveyor of human rights. The UK also comes in second place as a complicit sideshow to that. You know, the crowning achievement of this war of terror on the Afghani people is that now the Taliban, who they fought, are going to oust anybody that the Americans want, okay. and their points for a return to power. So the legacy of war and terror in the invasion of Afghanistan should never be forgotten. It can be summed up by saying it's probably the most destructive single biggest failure of the 21st century, certain for the Americans.
Thank you very much for that. Let me thank our guests. Unfortunately, we don't have any more time. Richard Becker spoke to us from San Francisco, from the Answer Coalition, and you were just listening to Simo Sinabas, journalist and political commentator there from London. Thank you for your contribution. And that does it for this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitavli and the entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program.
Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy is near. Time to give, time to share, time to show we care. Cause Ramadan is here. Whoa, Ramadan is here.
Today's lesson. The emphasis on hunger and thirst. The one who tolerates more hunger as well as ponders deeply about Allah as compared to others will be assigned higher exalted position before their Lord on the Day of Judgment. We have narrations which emphasize on staying hungry and thirsty during the holy month of Ramadan. Also, the Prophet said to Asma, O Asma, if you may act in a manner that when the angel of death approaches you,
he should find you hungry and thirsty. If you do it, you will attain the most exalted spiritual position. We'll join the ranks of prophets. We'll make the angels happy and will earn the divine salutations for yourself. Prophet also mentioned, keep your stomachs hungry and thirsty and make your bodies used to hardships. Perhaps your heart will then have a chance of seeing Allah's glory. Brothers and sisters, the holy month of Ramadan is filled with blessings. One of the blessings that every wayfarer can potentially attain is meeting with Allah, seeing Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And that seeing Allah is not with these two eyes that we have. No, seeing Allah through the spiritual eye of the heart, seeing Allah through the spiritual eye of the spirit and soul. That becomes possible. That becomes much easier in the month of Ramadan. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has been blessing his true servants for this visibility.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين مرحبا بالتائبين مرحبا بالعابدين في صلاة الخاشعين في رحاب الذاكرين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back to your listeners. Prophet of Allah, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he on his heavenly journey, which is also known as Mi'raj, he has narrated, O Ahmad, do you comprehend the outcome of fasting? Said, no. Who said so? He replied, the Prophet. The outcome of fasting is less eating and less talking, replied Allah. Then explained the outcome of silence and less speaking as follows. The result of silence is wisdom. The result of wisdom is enlightenment. The result of enlightenment is certainty. And when a person attains the exalted spiritual position of certainty, then he does not care how does he start his day, whether with ease or hardship, and tragedy or comfort. Such is the state of those who have attained the position of content. And whoever attains this position acquires three inseparable characteristics. Number one is thanks, which is shukr, not contaminated with ignorance. Number two is invocation, which is dhikr, not mixed with forgetfulness, and love, not with the love of others. This is what this blessed month, this holy month of Ramadan holds for us. We can attain these things. They are attainable. We can possibly get to those levels where the Urafa and the mystics of Islam have reached. We can get to those positions of nearness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the real creator and benefactor.
Forgive me for everything I've done in the past, when everything was going so fast, and now I just can't go on.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You are by my side. Oh.